So good evening, Shavua Tov. Thank you everybody for coming this evening. Generally, I like to speak about it. Tonight we're actually going to speak about it. We're going to speak about the learning of Gemara. In fact, when he asked me how many years I've been here, the only way I really can remember how many years I've been here is because I teach what's called a Daf Yomi Shir at 5:45 a.m. every morning. You're all welcome to come. Sundays it's only 7:15 if you want to come tomorrow morning. And that means that we study one page of Talmud a day, both the back and the front. It takes about 45 minutes to an hour per day. And it's a 7.5-year cycle. You may recall a couple of years ago there was an international, what they called the Siyam HaShas, the conclusion of the entire Talmud. So it takes 7.5 years. So this past June, I celebrated the completion of my first cycle. So he asked me how many years I've been here. So I know, 7.5 plus a half a year or so. So we're up to 8 years since coming here to moving to Wynwood. So why do we hold the Talmud in such esteem? That's really the topic I'd like to cover. And then it's going to extend to, as I started working through this, And why is there an assumption that it is binding? That there is something about that the Talmud seems to end something. Post-Talmud, there's a little bit of discussion. We could argue, there's a little bit of dispute, etc. But the Talmud kind of sets things. So how does that work? We know that the Torah, with the written Torah, we have an idea, Torah Tzivalanim, Hashem Moshe commanded the Torah. We assume what is in the written Torah, we understand that the canon ended with the closing of the Torah itself. And then something else happened with the closing of the Talmud. What was that? What is the significance of that as the way that the halacha would view that? Those are the two main topics with regards to the night. So the Gemara, we're going to start by learning a statement in the Gemara. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Baba Basra, in the Daf Yomi cycle about a year and a half ago, we came across this, Tana Rabbanan. Atir nechasim, atir pumbi. That somebody who is rich in possessions and rich in things, translated here as a pomp. Zehu bal hagados. This is a person who is very good at agados. What are agados? Agados are agadic teachings or homiletic teachings. So he is considered very wealthy. Why does the Gemara consider him so wealthy? Because he's the one who gets up on Shabbos morning in front of the entire synagogue and is able to speak. He speaks homiletics. He's able to teach these agadic teachings. So everybody thinks that he's so wise. So he's considered very wealthy. Next on the list here, Atir Siloyim Atir Tekoa, somebody who's rich in wealth and rich in oil. Tekoa is actually a place in Israel. Tekoa oil is known for its oil. So somebody who is wealthy with these types of things. So he is the Baal Pilpul. He is the one who is great in analytic understanding of the Gemara, the fighting, the give and take, etc. So he's considered having a lot of money. Why? So the Rashbam, the commentary that Gemara says, because he'll be able to always use that. He's the one who can always come up with ideas and extends this to something else and understands, oh yeah, that reminds me of another statement in the Talmud, etc. So he's considered very wealthy in that area. And then Atir Meshach and Atir Kamas, Zehu Baal Shmos, the one who is able to have, it says, products, or Kamas is really taxes, that somebody who has that, he is the Baal Shemuos. What does it mean, the Baal Shemuos? He is the one who recalls all of the previous teachings. So we need him, because when we say, oh yeah, what did he hold about this? What did that rabbi say about this or that? So he's the one who comes in handy. But Hakol Tzrichin Lemare Chatei. Everybody needs the one who owns the grain. What do you mean, the one who owns the grain? So the Gemara comments, that's the Gemara. The Gemara is really the source for all of these things. And if one learns through the Talmud, so they learn through. You learn, there's a lot about Chumash in the Talmud, a lot about the Tanakh, a lot about from the Bible itself. And then with regards to the laws and homiletic teachings, and it gets into medicine, and it gets into history, and it gets into all these different types of things. So the basis for all of these different things all emanates from the Talmud. And then it makes one more comment, Mar Rebbe Zera Amar. Rav, my dichsiv, what does it mean? Achol yimei ani rayim. What does the verse mean when it says all of the days are of the poor are evil? Ze baal gemara. He is considered a baal gemara, meaning he is considered poor and it's a difficult life. And then the Gemara continues, V'tov lov lev mishta tamid, the one who has a good heart, he's partying regularly, zeh bal mishnah. This is somebody who learns the Mishnah. What in the world does that mean? Why does the Gemara seem to be making a disparaging comment about itself? So what it means is, the Mishnah refers to laws. If I just learn law, so I have a somewhat easy, I have an easier life. It's easy just to learn the laws. I could just go law after law after law after law. I don't have to get involved with who disputes who and what argues on who, etc. The Gemara, however, that leads to the conflict. That's where the conflict's at. And sometimes also at the end, I feel like I haven't actually finished it, because the Talmud itself is considered endless. Another statement compares the Talmud to the ocean. The ocean is endless. There's no way to really get to the end of the Talmud. So if I can't get to the end, even if I do complete the entire cycle, I do go through, there's always more to conquer. There's always more to learn. There's always more to understand, etc. So on one hand, that's very exciting. On the other hand, I never accomplished anything. I never finished. And therefore, I'm considered always poor, because I realize how much more I have to conquer. So that is a sort of an introduction, that on one hand it's considered necessary for everything else. On the other hand, it's considered something that is a little bit disparaging, that I never actually concluded. So what is the goal? What are we attempting to do when we study the Talmud? So I am knocking off a little bit off of a sefer from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Everybody here heard of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein? He passed away about 2, 3, 4 years ago. He grew up in New York. He was the prime student of Rav Joseph Soloveitchik, who we'll get to shortly. He was actually married Rav Soloveitchik's daughter. He was Rav Soloveitchik's daughter-in-law. He was really next in line to become the next leader. Son-in-law, sorry. Right, he was, you're right, keep track of that. He was really in line to become the next leader of what we would call modern Orthodoxy in America, after the Rav would pass away. Instead, he decided, I'm moving to the land of Israel, went and settled in near Efrat, in what yeshiva now, Har Etzion, in the Etzion block, and that yeshiva is now Blossom. That is what we refer to as Yeshiva Har Etzion, or the Gush, you may have heard of. So that is his yeshiva that he developed with Rav Amital. So many of his works have been published over the last couple of years, and the first in the first of these English books that came out, the very first essay is entitled, Why Learn Gemara? So we'll turn to that in order to at least begin our shir. So he gives 4 reasons, and I'll be giving 4 reasons that are roughly based off of him. He writes in a very deep English, so we'll go based off of those reasons. So the first thing he writes, I only have a couple of paragraphs from him. So in source number 2, he says the Gemara is actually what he refers to as the terra firma of halacha, the very basis of halacha. A lot of what the Gemara it comments, I mean, the Mishnah will state a law, and the Gemara will make a comment. Where did the Mishnah get that from? How did it know it? And it's going to either try to dig up a source in Tanakh or a verse someplace, and it's going to figure out what the basis is. And by the assumption then is that is the basis of Jewish law. I mean, we know what the law is. Where does it come from? And by getting a better understanding of where it's coming from, so then I'll be able to understand how to apply it in other types of situations. He says, for example, right, you have to know that how many law students have ever seen Justinian or Coke, or for that matter, surveyed Marbury versus Madison. It is incalculably important, however, with respect to Talmud Torah, whose study is enjoined as a religious experience rather than as an intellectual exercise. On the experiential plane, recourse to secondary and tertiary texts may simplify, but it almost certainly dilutes. Meaning, when you're learning the Talmud, you're learning the real thing. You're learning the real thing, and you're learning the real basis, and that is useful in order to then apply whatever you're learning to other areas. I'm going to get back to the second paragraph he mentions and move on to another comment that is made by Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik, writing in one of the books that he actually wrote, entitled Halachic Man, although what we have as Halachic Man is a translation of what he originally wrote, but was published during his lifetime. And he makes a comment that when one learns the Talmud, you don't see the world in the same way. You don't see the world in the same way. Everything that you look at in the world now becomes something connected to halacha. It becomes something I'm not just looking at trees anymore. I'm now looking at, what is that connection to Tu Bishvat? Tu Bishvat is this week. Is the 3 years passed up? Am I permitted to eat it? Am I not permitted to eat it? Etc. He gives 3 examples in his book of when I look at things, right? The Talmud gives me views, glasses on how to look at the world, not just as the world, but as a halachic gymnasium, I don't know, as a halachic environment. So the first example he gives him, there is no phenomenon or entity, I'm looking here at source number 4, or object in this concrete world, which is a priori halacha, does not approach with its ideal standard. When halachic man comes across a spring bubbling quietly, he already possesses a fixed relationship with that phenomenon. What is that phenomenon he's looking at? If he sees a spring that is bubbling, he's looking at it and saying, that's a mikvah. Right, that's not just water that's flowing. That is a mikvah. If it is emanating from the ground, if it's flowing, I'm permitted to use that for immersion. If it's not coming out from the ground, it's only connected to a rainwater source, it can't be flowing, it has to be standing still. It has to, right? That's the difference between what you call a mikvah and a mayan, a immersion bath versus a spring. And he's looking at it in that particular way. So the next paragraph he says, when one looks at the western horizon and sees the fading rays of sun, or the eastern horizon and sees the first light of dawn, he's not just looking and saying, wow, what a wonderful sunrise. He's also looking at it and saying, ah, it's time to go to davening now. That means I'm permitted to start davening. On Purim, I'm allowed to start the Megillah. I'm allowed to, all of the mitzvos of the day are now applicable, not just because it reached whatever time it is, but because the sun is rising. The sun is now a symbol of the beginning of doing mitzvos, and when it's setting, it's also a symbol of either the end time of doing certain commandments or the beginning time of doing other commandments. Or he says, when you look at mountains, mountains are not just mountains. Mountains are now walls with regards to cutting off my domain, right? If I have a mikvah, not a mikvah, excuse me, an eruv on Shabbos, so our eruv in this area is mostly wires, but if a mountain, actually we have some boundaries of our eruv here surrounding this neighborhood, we don't actually use wires, we use a steep hill. If a hill is steep enough, you don't need wires there, that qualifies as the boundary. So you look at mountains not just as a mountain as Hashem's creation, but also a usage. It has a usage in halacha. It's applicable to Jewish law. As I started getting involved with the Eruv here, I started realizing every time that I was driving up the New Jersey Turnpike, you know, they have those electric wires that go along the side, I couldn't stop thinking about it. So does that qualify as an Eruv? Would that, because it goes over in a particular way? And now, as you mentioned, I have a little business here, mezuzah and more. So last week, I took our kids... Torah Academy was on vacation this past week. Yeshiva week break, so what are we going to do with our kids all day? So we actually took a trip. I crossed something else off the things you need to do when you live in Philadelphia list, and we went to the Eastern State Penitentiary. So now I'm wandering around the entire penitentiary wondering, so where would I put a mezuzah on that, on those bars? Would it go there or would it go there? You start thinking about the world in a different way. But another thing that Rav Lichtenstein says, and this is kind of his reasons 3, and it will take us into reasons 4 as well, and that is actually what Rav Lichtenstein counts as a second reason, and that is underlined in source 2, and then we're going to go to source 5. The underlined part in source 2 is, to open a Gemara is to enter into their overwhelming presence, to feel the force of their collective personalities. With regards to the Chachamim, I am now no longer studying ancient people from the past, I am now intertwined with them. I am now in discussions with them. And there's two pieces that Rav Soloveitchik describes, one about when he is very old, and one about when he is very young, that are just beautiful pieces of learning. The first one, when he describes when he is very old, he talks about himself. This is actually, the title of the essay is The First Jewish Grandfather. He talks about Avraham's relationship to Yaakov. That's what the essay is about. But he concludes by talking about himself. He says, when I go into the shir room, I'm an old man already. I'm very tired. And I'm wondering, how in the world am I going to make it through this shir? But it's okay, I bring help. I bring a couple of people with me. And as we start going through the Talmud, I describe the people of the Talmud, and he's talking about an advanced shir. And I have other guests as well. I bring in the Rambam. Maimonides comes, and he gives the shir along with me. He is a guest with me in the room. And he describes, the Rebbe introduces the guest to his pupil, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam states halacha. The Ravid disagrees sharply. The Ravid is the one who constantly is arguing on the Rambam, on Maimonides, as is his wont. Some students interrupt to defend the Rambam, and they express themselves harshly against the Ravid, as young people are apt to do. The Rebbe softly corrects the students and suggests more restrained tones. The Rashba, somebody else, another Rishon, he comes in, he smiles as well. The Rebbe tries to analyze what the students meant, and the other students intercede. Rabbeinu Tam, another commentary, he's the main Bali Atosvos. He comes in and states his opinion, and suddenly a symposium of generations comes into existence. Young students debate debate earlier generations with an air of daring familiarity, and a crescendo of discussion ensues. We often think about the earlier generations as being untouchable. Right, we often think about that we have a concept called Yuridas Hadoros, that the generations have descended. Who are we to connect to them? But if one goes into a base medrash and sees how people are arguing over a piece of Gemara that was written 2,000 years ago, what did Rav Yehuda HaNasi mean? And then what did the Rambam mean 1,000 years ago? How could Rashi possibly have said that? So on one hand, you are recognizing their greatness as it deserves analysis. On the other hand, you're putting yourself in the same place, right? You're putting yourself, well, what do I think about this? Which is really an amazing situation. And in fact, is very unique. The way that I realized that this uniqueness, also a personal experience, when I was in Yeshiva University studying for ordination, so we're learning in the base medrash in the morning, and the base medrash is a room three times the size of this room. There's 400 guys studying, and it's loud, and you have to yell in order to be heard. And all of a sudden, the rabbi, who the mashkiach of the yeshiva, Rabbi Blau, he stands up at the lectern. I have an announcement to make. Because of some connections that the university has, we're going to have 40 cardinals, Catholic cardinals, come in. They've heard about a Beit Midrash, and they want to see it in action. So don't mind them. Just continue doing what you're doing. And 10 minutes later, in walk four cardinals in the full garb. They tucked away their necklaces, the crosses. And they were seeing this as a very unique thing. If you think about most seminaries, they're quiet, and everybody's at their cubicle, and you're studying, and you're not supposed to make a sound. And this is an extremely unique idea. A, arguing with your friend, sometimes arguing with your Rebbe, arguing with your teacher, but also arguing with the Rambam, Rashba, Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbi Yehuda Hadasi, Abaye, Rava, etc. And the Rav brings this home as well. Rav Salvechik brought this home in another description, not when he was very old, but the description of him being very young. And he describes, and that's on the back of the page, source number 7, by what time are we supposed to go to? 9? 5-9, okay. So Rav Salvechik describes in an essay also he wrote called Uvikashta Misham.
Sorry,
9:15. Okay. From him we shall seek. I turn to the back of the page. But first I'm going to talk by heart because I only could fit so much on the page. And Rav Salvechik describes that when he was younger, when he was very young, so he said he lived for a while in his grandfather's house, Rav Eliyahu Feinstein. In fact, if you've heard Rav Moshe Feinstein, so Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Salvechik were cousins. They were close with one another, and they were related through this. I think they were first or second cousins. So he said, he describes that his father would learn lived by his father-in-law, it's very Feinstein. His father was Rav Moshe Salvechik. Rav Moshe Salvechik was learning, but also there were a couple of students that started learning with him. So they were learning in his grandfather's living room. His grandfather's living room also happened to be young Yosef Salvechik's bedroom. So he's studying with his group of people, and Rav Salvechik is sitting on a bench, and he says, I was very lonely growing up. I didn't have too many friends. But I had one friend, his name was the Rambam. And he describes on this first page, I have one friend, please don't laugh at me, Maimonides. How did we become friends? We met. Because the Rambam was a regular guest in our house. And then he describes that his father was teaching. He always spoke about the Rambam. And the students would, and that's where we actually pick up on the back of the page here. My father would then say that the criticisms and objections of the Ravid are correct. I mean, he talked about the Gemara, and then he invoked the Rambam, Maimonides' comment, and then he would quote why the Ravid argues on the Rambam, and he says, yeah, the Ravid has a very good argument against the Rambam. And then people would start jump up, and they would start challenging, etc. And father would say, well, this is a very good question. And then he would start to talk, and I get to the next paragraph. I did not understand anything at all about the issue under discussion, right? He was a young boy. But two impressions were formed in my young, innocent mind. Number one, the Rambam was surrounded by opponents and enemies who wanted to harm him, right? He constantly had to fight on behalf of the Rambam. Number two, his only defender was my father. If not for my father, who knew what would happen to the Rambam? I felt that the Rambam himself was present in the living room, listening to what father was saying. The Rambam was sitting with me on my bed. What did he look like? I don't really know, but his countenance resembled my father's good and beautiful face. He had the same name as my father, Moshe. Father would speak, the students, their eyes fixed upon him, would listen intently to what he was saying. Slowly, slowly the tension ebbed. The father strode boldly and bravely. New arguments emerged. Halachic rules were formulated and defined with wondrous precision. A new light shone. The difficulties were resolved. The passage was explained. The Rambam emerged the winner. Father's face shone with joy. He had defended his friend, Rabbeinu Moshe, the son of Maimon. A smile of satisfaction appeared on the Rambam's lips as well. I too participated in this joy. I was happy and excited. I would jump out of bed and run to my father's room and tell her, run to my mother's room and tell her the joyful news. Mother, mother, the Rambam's right. He defeated the Ravid. Father came out and said how wonderful father is. Right? He's so excited as a young boy. But occasionally the Rambam's luck did not hold. His enemies attacked him on all sides. The difficulties were as hard as iron. Father was unable to follow the logic of the position. He tried with all his might to defend him, but he was unsuccessful. Father would sink into musings with his head leaning on his fist. The students and I, and even the Rambam himself, would tensely wait for father's answers. But father would pick up his head and say, "The answer, we have to wait for Eliyahu to come. What the Rambam says is extremely difficult. There is no expert who can explain it. The issue remains in need of clarification." What we call in yeshiva, tzarech iyun, needs more clarification. The whole group, my father included, were sad to the point of tears. A silent agony expressed itself on each face. Tears come from my eyes too. I would even see a bright eardrop in the Rambam's eyes. Slowly I would go to my mother and tell her with a broken heart, "Mother, father can't resolve the Rambam. What are we going to do?" "Don't be sad," mother would answer. "Father will find a solution. And if he doesn't find one, then maybe when you grow up, you'll resolve his words. The main thing is to learn Torah with joy and excitement." How beautiful is that? I love reading that every time. Right? How he's describing his involvement. I see all the people around, and that's what the Gemara brings us. It doesn't just give us the laws, it gives us the discussion. It gives us the give and take. And now a person who is studying it has entered the world of that discussion, has entered the world of, I'm one of them. I'm not necessarily one of them that I know as much of them. I certainly have to have respect for all of them. I remember when I was in 11th grade, we were learning Gemara, and there was a comment that we learned from the Ritva, another commentary on the Gemara. And I just remember clearly saying, "But the Ritva doesn't make any sense." And my Rebbe almost beat me up. He didn't touch me, but he could have. He said, "Oh, sure, you're 11th grade, and you're saying it doesn't make any sense. Well, so you don't know anything." But yet, a person has now entered, right? We've entered that world. So one has to be respectful, hesitant, but yet one is now part. They're now part of the Mesorah. They're now part of the tradition. And that perhaps, that is the uniqueness that the Gemara gives us, perhaps over other texts that one sees. So I'm about to go on to part two. Any questions or points thus far that you want to comment? Yes? Yeah.
It has to be right. Now, how can you move on from it? I mean, this is so fixed that it has to be justified as it is.
So we have an assembly. When one goes through the yeshiva system, you are ingrained with this attitude of that the Rishonim, what we refer to as the early sages, Rambam, Ravid, Rashi, right? They all knew everything, right? They knew everything. In fact, the attitude comes from the Talmud itself, because the Talmud itself will have an argument amongst Amoraim, right? Later sages in the Talmud, and the question will be, how could you say that? Don't you know about the Mishnah here? Right? Don't you know that there's a Mishnah in someplace else that seems to say that seems to say the opposite? And sometimes the question is even, why are you saying this, later sage, Shmuel, Abai, Rava, Ravashi, Ravina? Don't you know that there's a Mishnah that seems to say the same thing? And therefore, why would you be saying, there's an assumption you knew every Mishnah, obviously. And the Gemara then worked to try to figure out, what was he adding? What is he saying different than what the Mishnah said? So we are kind of ingrained with that idea of that they knew all the Gemara. They knew every Mishnah. They knew every Gemara. Sometimes there's a thought that maybe they didn't have a certain text or something, and that's why he says something. But that's the way that the resolution is going to come internally, not just, oh, the Rambam obviously didn't know something, right? That's the assumption heading into the Beis Medrash, that all of those people across the bookshelves, they know it all, and if something that they're saying seems to be contradicted by something else, or I don't understand what they're saying, it's a me problem, it's not a them problem. So what Rav Moshe Soloveitchik is doing, I don't understand the Rambam, he's kind of shrugging his shoulder and saying, the Rambam's not wrong, I just don't get it right now. And Eliyahu Navi will come and explain it. Or as the mother of Rav Soloveitchik said to his son, her son, maybe when you get older, you'll be, have the opportunity to there'll be a place for you as well.
Cars that drive themselves. People have to figure out how these ancient halachas. What would those rabbis have said in those circumstances and situations that didn't occur?
Correct. I mean, they're talking about principles, right? What is what you're really learning Gemara in terms of the halachic attitude is what is the principle that they're setting up? And then how is that going to apply to new modern things? How is it going to apply in the modern world? Right? That's what a posek is attempting to do. Not necessarily when one is. That's sort of the next step. You're learning the Talmud to understand the Talmud. Then I can figure out what the principle is the Talmud is teaching us as it goes through the prism of 2,000 years of sages. Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, Mishnah Berurah, etc. Until, okay, now how do we see a driverless car? I don't know. Right? How does that then apply to a modern day circumstance? And that's why people like me can earn a living, plus we can try to figure out interesting shirim about how to do that. Yeah?
I was really struck by your story about the cardinals that went to Yeshiva.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amusing, but I think it's very interesting because it highlights, I think, the difference between a traditional Jewish approach and a Catholic approach, in which essentially everything comes down from the hierarchy,
yeah,
lower and lower, and you accept it or you're out of there.
Yeah.
Whereas we can question and argue amongst each other, hopefully in a friendly way.
That's true.
To reach the truth, I think that's. I'm sure, in all our opinion, that is a much superior way.
Sure, yes, it is. Yeah.
It seems like you have to find the truth that's already there. It can't move.
Well, that is the assumption, and I'm an Orthodox rabbi from down the block, that's our assumption, right? We assume that it's there, and it's just up to us to uncover where it is. I mean, even though there's different, I think I gave a class once entitled, right, did Moshe Rabbeinu paskin on a smartphone or something? Like, did he decide laws with regards to the smartphone? So the assumption is no, but the principles that he's laid out are then able to be used for things that come up with a smartphone or any other modern day thing. I think there is an answer. There is a source for these things for us to figure out. Yes?
How does this whole system of debate and arguing with the ancient ones as well as the ones in the room, how does it mold the student? What is his... You tell that you were critical and your rabbi came down on you like a trick.
Right.
But he also would have allowed you, maybe had you expressed it differently,
right.
He would have allowed you the leeway. He wouldn't have said...
Yes, right. He was upset at the attitude. He was upset at my being presumptuous. He wasn't upset at me asking, how does this fit with this Gemara? That's what he wants us to do. I have him to say, for us to then assume, because I don't understand it, therefore it doesn't make sense... Right, that's what he was upset with. Right, in fact, we have a prohibition in the Torah called a zakin mamre. A zakin mamre is somebody who looks for a psak. He has a question, and he goes to the Beis Din for a resolution, or he comes up with his own position on something, and he's brought to the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin, the central court in Yerushalayim, decides against him. So if he goes off and decides, well, I'm not listening to them, I'm still going to continue to do this. See, he's what we call a zakin mamre, and he actually, that's considered like terror. He's carries with it a death penalty, and not just any death penalty, like a public, that's where we gather everybody around, we want everybody to know that this guy is, right, because to challenge that, to assume I'm going to do otherwise, that's going to break down the system. But to go and say, look, I don't understand it, but I'm going to do it anyways, it's okay. That's okay. That's acceptable. Nothing's wrong with that. That's just a person who's questioning, and that certainly fits within the confines of our religion. So in terms of what's... So I want to continue on a little bit. and discuss really the binding nature of the Talmud. So right, the Torah is unassailable, whatever is in the text, whatever is in those scrolls, right? So we take those scrolls, and we figure out what those scrolls are talking about. We go verse by verse, and even letter by letter, and this teaches this law, and this teaches that law, right? We're not going to disagree with what's in the scrolls. Can one disagree with what's in the Talmud? So if the answer is yes, so then, okay, fine, the answer is yes. Our assumption is no, as we'll see shortly. If the answer is no, at what point does that no continue? So can I disagree with the Rambam? Can I disagree with what we call the Shulchan Aruch, which came later on? Can I disagree with sages of this generation? I mean, where does that line end of, I'm going to disagree, and what's my disagreeing going to be based on? Really, it's not just, I think differently. It's, I have a different understanding of the sources than you do. So where does that line end? So the Rambam, Maimonides, in his introduction to what he called the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam wrote three major works number one was his commentary on the Mishnah. The second was what he called the Guide to the Perplexed, the Mor Nevuchim, and the third, which is the most major work, well, depending on where you're studying. In yeshivas, the college, the university world, the Rambam's most famous for the Guide to the Perplexed. In the yeshivas, he's known for the Mishneh Torah, his halachic book, and who opens a Guide to the Perplexed? Right? That's for rabbis to give in shuls and stuff. So the Rambam, in his introduction to to his code of law, to the Mishneh Torah. So he writes as follows. He gives an entire history of the Torah world, starting from Adam HaRishon until today. He connects the entire chain of the Mesorah, the tradition, person after person after person. And then he comments, he says the following line. He says, "Al kol dvarim shebegemara habavli," everything that's in the Babylonian Talmud. I mean, not the Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. Why that is, we'll have to talk about another time. Chayvin kol Yisrael aleches behen. All of the Jews are obligated to follow. V'kofin kol ir ve'ir v'chol medina u'medina linhog b'chol habin hagel shenagu chachmi ha'gemar v'ligzur gzeirosam v'aleches b'tiknosam. And we have to force every city and every country, meaning every area, has to follow that Talmud. The line before I should comment is, the Rambam says, why do I need to write my book? Because if you drive around, I live in Egypt, but if you drive around to Iraq and Iran and there, and then if you go to Europe or if you go to Spain, so everybody's doing different things. A lot of different customs have developed, and it's just become very difficult to wield. So Rambam says, on one hand, customs that people have, that's okay. They could keep their customs. But everybody is bound by the Talmud. That's what he says. You're obligated to follow the Talmud, and that's what I'm going to be teaching here in my book. My book is going to be the laws as seen via the Talmud. And he says, why is that? Why is everybody held to that standard? He says, Hoel v'chol osam hadvarim shebegemara, hiskimu aleihem kol Yisrael. That everything that is written in the Torah, in the Talmud, all of the Jews already agreed to. What is he to? When? How did that happen? All right, he says, everything in the Talmud, all of the Jews agreed to what's in the Talmud. The Rambam says this, and then he moves on. So what is that? Was there a convention in the 400-500s that everybody got together and said, we hereby all agree that the Talmud is going to work? So the truth is, if you go back a little bit, and we alluded to this before, how did things get agreed to before? How did things? There is actually a verse in the Torah that when there is a question that arises amongst Klal Yisrael, so what do you do? So you go to the Sanhedrin. You go to and they're going to tell you what the correct halacha is. So what was the Sanhedrin? What was that? So that was a central body, 71 sages. They represented the positions of all of the rabbis, and they came to a conclusion. How'd they come to a conclusion? Was it consensus? Not really. They came to a conclusion by voting. Whoever won the vote, that was what the law was going to be, and it was going to be established that way. That was an established law. That was it. There wasn't a way that you were going to be able to come and overturn the law that was decided by the Sanhedrin that was in Yerushalayim. Okay. The problem is, and that should help today, right? We should no longer have any disputes, just send to the Sanhedrin. The problem is, of course, we don't have a Sanhedrin. So when did the Sanhedrin run out? When was there no longer a Sanhedrin? So it's a little, it kind of, ebbed away. There's something called smicha. Smicha is what the Gemara refers to as smicha, ordination, is really a directly from Moshe Rabbeinu down to Yeshua, down generation. That stopped at some point. One of the rules is that smicha has to be given in Israel. And the Gemara comments that all the people today that are called rabbi, that's really fake smicha, right? So I'm perfectly willing to admit that I have a fake smicha, right? I don't have the official one that comes back. Really what I have is permission to decide halacha. That my rabbi said he knows these things well enough that he can answer questions. But I don't really have that status. That's necessary for the Sanhedrin to exist. Okay. The Sanhedrin didn't exist by the closing of the Gemara either, nor did it exist by the closing of the Mishnah. So what's the Rambam talking about that everybody agreed? So you can't be talking about that, meaning everybody got together and everybody agreed by way of the Sanhedrin. Well, that didn't exist anymore. So what could he possibly be talking about? So there was a rabbi called Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman lived in the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s. He was the Rosh Yeshiva Yeshiva in Baranovich. He is Baranovich in, I'm not sure, Poland or Lithuania, someplace there. He could perhaps claim, if you've heard the concept of Das Torah, if you've heard that concept out there, he would be the originator. Don't want to go there. He is very prominent, known. He actually died by the hands of the Nazis. He was actually in America. He came to America in the 30s to raise money for his yeshiva. Was told by people, you know, don't go back. Things are getting very dangerous there. He said, no, a captain goes with his ship. And he went and he stayed with his yeshiva, ended up in Vilna, ended up in northern Lithuania, ended up back, and ended up being captured. And was executed by the Nazis. Therefore, he's Hashem Yikom Damam. Hashem should avenge his blood. So he wrote his yeshiva Baranovich, even though he was known as one of the Gedolim in Europe, one of the great sages in Europe, his yeshiva Baranovich would qualify really as a high school. It was really people that in their teenage years, they would go to Baranovich to begin their studies, and they would go to other yeshivas such as Mir was for older students, or Slobodko's for older students, but he was mostly our mid-teenagers, 13, 14, 15, 16. So he wrote a sefer, really a pamphlet, called the Kuntres Divrei Sofrim. These are the things of our tradition, the words. This is how we can kind of track our tradition. And he develops the following idea. He says that what was the Sanhedrin? Sanhedrin was a representative of all of the rabbis of the Jews. Right? Now it's not for all the rabbis to get together, that's too unwieldy. So we're going to just take 70 of them. It's like a democracy, right? We'll have them as being representative of all the rabbis. Whatever they say, that will be good. What happens after they were gone? So suggests Rav Elchanan Wasserman, based on sources in the Rambam, that idea could also be established by what he calls Rov Chachmei Yisrael. That if the majority of the rabbis of Israel would get together, they would have a status of a Sanhedrin. They would have the same status. So they would be able to paskin on these types of questions that would come up later. So if something is not clear, so we have a question, so how are we going to decide it? Well, get all the rabbis together in the world, that will be the equivalent of a Sanhedrin, we'll be able to resolve it. Well, that's not so practical today, much more so back in the, a couple thousand years ago. That's not going to work out very well. But he says that if that just gets agreed to, if we just see that there has been a consensus that has formed amongst the rabbis of the world, that is going to be sufficient in order to establish that as being the halacha. So that he suggests that that's really what's going on with regards to the Gemara. That's what the Rambam meant with that line. Shebegemara hiskimu aleihem kol Yisrael, that all of Yisrael agreed to it, meaning enough of the rabbis agreed to it that we're going to count that as binding law. Right? Pretty much a lot, most of the 90% of the rabbis were living in that area, living in the Middle East. They all were aware of the Talmud being written. They all were aware of it being, although how exactly it was written and concluded, it probably was a several century process. But they were all aware of that process taking place. It was before things got more spread out, which really happened around the year 900, 1000, that era. So this is kind of taking place in the 700s, 800s. People are willing to accept the Talmud as binding. And that's what he said. And that's the halacha. That's what's gone on from generations following. That is added in by an idea from Rav Shlomo Fisher. Shlomo Fisher is still alive today. He is very, very much in the Haredi world, but also known as being very open. He has a sefer. I brought the prop with me here. Drushos Beis Yishai is his svarim that come from him. And he points out in his in an essay entitled "Be'inyan Kabbalas Harabim," the idea of the acceptance of the masses. He says, realize that that idea that the Rambam is talking about, that everybody accepted, it didn't actually happen formally. There wasn't some big dais someplace in a stadium where everybody got together and said, "Hey, everybody, raise your hand. Yes, everybody agree." And it didn't exactly work that way. He says, "V'dad the Kabbalah Zu," this is source number 10. "Sha'anu Omrim Ein Perusha Shayesham Biyom Misuyam Maimad Shel Kabbalah." That there was on one specific day an idea that everybody got together and accepted it. Right? The Migila Li Razeh. Who revealed this secret? Right? If they really got all the Jews together, we would have known about it. Right? There would have been some kind of pamphlet. There would have been sponsors. There certainly would have been food served. And there would have been receipts. Right? We would know about that taking place. He said the reason why we don't have those receipts is because it never actually happened in that way. It just happened because over a period of time, it just became accepted that that was going to be the Psak Din. And that happened. Now, could that conceivably happen again? So, it hasn't, with regards to an official body of work. I mean, the Rambam wrote his work saying, I'm going to write my work, and that's going to be the decision that everybody's going to be able to follow. It's going to be much better than the Talmud, because the Talmud is all spread out. It's very difficult to find things. I'm going to have everything organized in a specific way, and everybody's going to agree with me. The problem is not everybody agreed with him. The Rambam wasn't able to get that consensus that the Talmud was able to gain. One can make a case as well with the Shulchan Aruch. In fact, there's even more of a reason, because there was actually possibly a reinstitution of smicha that took place in Tzfat in the 1500s. Not for now. But it might have actually happened, and there might have actually been real smicha bestowed upon the author of the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo, which gives that work an immense amount of power. But was that accepted by everybody? Not really. It was accepted, except for all the places where somebody argues on it, which is everywhere. Right? Open up a Shulchan Aruch. A Shulchan Aruch has about this much writing, and it's this much commentaries on it. People fighting, defending, arguing, etc. So although the Shulchan Aruch is popular, and it's used as a premise for modern-day halacha, Lord Rabbi Cooper, right? It never was accepted as, we're all going to follow that, and we're not going to follow anything else. It never achieved that. And the same thing, and no other work has been able to achieve that. So that would explain why Rav Moshe Feinstein, in fact, writes in one of his responses, he actually has a response about a woman going to the mikvah, and there is clearly some kind of issue with regards to something in her ears. So that possibly could disqualify her from being able to go and immerse in a mikvah because she has something in her ears. She had some kind of infection that wouldn't allow it to get wet. And Rav Moshe Feinstein has a responsa where he says, I think it's permitted for her to go, and he gives his reasoning for why he thinks it's permitted for her to go. Then there's another one, what the title being Ode Be'inyan Hey Nun Lamed. What does that mean? More about the above. Hanisker Le'el. More about what I wrote above. And then he has another response with the same thing. And another, there's six. There's actually six responses on that topic. Why is it that there's six responses on the same topic? Because there's clearly some guy on the other side that kept writing to Rav Moshe Feinstein arguing about why he thinks that he's wrong. And in fact, in the sixth one, Rosha throws up his hands and says, listen, I think I'm right. And even if there are what he refers to as Rishonim, what would we mean the Rambam, Rashba, Ritva, etc., even if they have those people argue against me, it's okay. I'm allowed to fight against them. I'm allowed to argue against them. Now, I wouldn't argue. That's what my Rebbe beat me up for, right? I'm not allowed to do that. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says, I know the Talmud enough. I've been able to establish the principle enough that despite the fact that you're able to bring some people who might have understood it differently, I think I'm right. And therefore, I'm going to say that she could go to the mikveh despite the fact that perhaps you're objecting to it. Now, Rav Moshe would not say that about the Talmud. He can't say, well, I disagree with the statement of the Talmud. Right? He wouldn't do that. But from that point and onwards, he's saying there's nothing else since then that has been canonized. I would suggest that there might be specific laws that were canonized beyond that. Right? That possibly is, there are things, especially when we get to modern day ideas. So how does one view an electric light? What is that? What is an electric light? So there was a lot of fighting about it in the beginning when it first was developed. One could find many sources about this, about a lot of electric appliances from that time. You could actually, there's a website called HebrewBooks.org. HebrewBooks.org was originally, now it just has tons and tons of stuff on it, but it was originally developed as a way of highlighting early American Sfarim, American writings. There were rabbis who came from Europe that were brilliant, huge Talmidei Chachamim, where the rabbis in the middle of nowhere, and wrote books, and wrote very powerful books, and what happened to all that stuff? So somebody said, I'm going to make a website, we're going to collect all of those things. Included in that is a magazine that existed in the 30s, 40s, and 50s called Hapardes. Hapardes is a halachic magazine, about 30 pages a session, which existed for about 30 years. The reason it's called Hapardes is because the editor's last name was Pardes, I believe. So he organized this magazine out of Chicago, and there are these fights back and forth, and there are ads. There's actually, I gave a share a couple of years ago about the kashrus of Coke. Why do we assume that Coca-Cola was kosher in the 20s? And this fight exists on the, you can actually see ads for Coca-Cola and arguments about whether we should rely on its kashrus, etc., in this magazine. So one could say there's arguments about these appliances, the refrigerators and stuff, as they're coming into play in terms of using them on Shabbos and the such. But after a little bit of time, there became a consensus. That consensus suggests Rav Elchanan Wasserman and Rav Shlomo Fisher. That consensus would be the equivalent of Rov Chachmei Yisrael. The Chachmei Yisrael got together and said, okay, that's going to be the Psak, that's going to be the decision. One can make the same case about an Eruv. There's a huge fight, you might be aware, there's huge fights about Eruvs, whether they're applicable or not, etc. Whether we should have them in these types of neighborhoods. Ultimately, B'nai Yisrael decided that we're going to have them because communities that don't have Eruvs don't have too many Jews for much longer, right? Forget it. I'm moving to the place that does have the Eruv. Forget the idea that there's going to be a stringency, etc. Okay. One more topic that I just want to touch on, and that comes from my Rebbe. My Rebbe, Rav Herschel Schachter, you may have heard the name. He's actually one of the main authorities for the Orthodox Union in terms of deciding their kashrus. So those that consume OU products, you're doing it based on his okay, not the okay hashkacha, his okay, saying it's good. And he discusses the idea. So how does one change? I mean, how does one adapt or seek changes? So he goes through it. Talked about an article in Jewish Action. That's the magazine of the Orthodox Union in 2010. Changes in practice require delicate evaluations that only a master Torah scholar or gadol b'Torah can properly conduct. Only someone with broad knowledge and deep understanding of the corpus of halacha, intimate familiarity, etc. He's the one that's going to be able to determine how we're going to be able to apply change and things of that nature. A couple of weeks ago, someone named Rabbi Zev Elif, he's about my age, he has put it, there's a website out there called The Lair House, which is, translates, mean the study house, but it's a website that's been collecting articles, mostly from within the modern Orthodox world. He wrote an article called The Between the Lines Faith of Rav Herschel Schachter. The Between the Lines Faith of Rav Herschel Schachter. So what is he talking about? So he makes reference to this article and is talking about, you know, who's going to make these decisions. And what Rav Schachter is essentially saying is that through all the generations, and that's what the Rambam was laying out and others laid out, throughout the generations there has been somebody, what he refers to as the Baal HaMesorah, the one who is responsible for making sure, or people that are responsible to make sure that the tradition gets passed on from generation to generation in an appropriate way. And how does one decide who's one of those Baal HaMesorah? How do you get to be in that club? I don't know. You just are. You just are. In fact, you could track down, there's a New York Times article, an interview that was given by Rav Moshe Feinstein to the New York Times in the 70s, where they asked him, how did you get to be this guy whose phone is constantly running, you know, ringing off the hook with people calling you with halacha questions? To which Rav Moshe responds with a shrug of his shoulders, I don't really know. It just happened. It just happened that way, that people started calling and just build up, and people called me, and I answered the questions. They liked what they heard, so they called me more. And that's how it works. And get passed on, and it's been going on like this for thousands and thousands of years. So Rabbi Elif concludes, so what is that idea that gets transferred on? How do we know that it's going to be safe? How do we know that it's going to be okay? And he suggests that's the faith. That's the emunah that is involved in the process. That there has to be enough faith, there has to be enough trust in the system that we're not going to force things, that we're going to allow the Gemara to continue to exist, continue to thrive. Those discussions, the arguments that are taking place are not supposed to knock off the Gemara, but rather it obviously makes it stronger, makes it bigger, and bring more and more people into that tradition, more and more people into that discussion. And as the generations continue on and on and on and on and on, so the Gemara, the Talmud, continues to be the vibrant text that it was thousands of years ago, continues to be Bizman Hazeh, and the Mesorah, the tradition, is able to continue on. So that's my presentation. I guess we have a few more minutes, I guess? A few more minutes. So we can take a few questions on stuff. Yes, Dan?
Well, a comment and I guess a question.